The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. We can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So for those of you who do not know, and let me know if you can't hear me. For those of you who do not know, a while ago I got a virus that entered my heart, actually did a lot of damage, and I've been quite sick from it. And it's taken a while to get better. I had to have a pacemaker and defibrillator. And the reason I mention this is that some fellow lay practitioners that I've known for years were talking to me about how I was doing, and they asked if I would give a talk about some of the things I had learned from this experience. So this Dharma talk, as they all are, is from the heart. So anyway, the Buddha taught about the impermanence of all things. Nothing lasts forever. All is in an ever-changing flux. You know, we all know we're going to die, but the reality is that we think it'll happen sometime, a long time from whenever, where we are right now. But in reality, we could die at any moment. The Buddha taught, life is uncertain, and death is certain. But it's interesting because a lot of people didn't pay attention to the Buddha when he said that either. So we have this problem. Dogen, for those of you who are new, Dogen was the ancestor that brought our form of Buddhism from China to Japan. And he's the one who wrote Rules for Meditation that you read as yesterday as part of the intro retreat. Anyway, Dogen says in the very first lines of the Shishogi, the most important questions for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely for them. Should you be able to find the Buddha within birth and death, they both vanish. What do you think he meant when he said to find the Buddha within birth and death? How can birth and death vanish? If you've ever been at a birth other than your own or to a death of someone, you know that birth and death are quite potent and powerful experiences. So what's he talking about? What's he pointing to? This Dharma talk is not going to directly answer these questions. These questions are for you to sit with at times in your life and bring them up and contemplate them and come to your answers, because they do make sense. There is something going on. All my life as a lay Buddhist and then as a monk, I have tried to hold impermanence in front of my face, aware, oh yeah, I could die. Oh yeah, life is uncertain. And I came to this practice because of the fire of birth and death, because my first daughter died at birth. So I really was looking for an understanding of how that could have happened. Why did it happen? And of course, as a new trainee, I was reading the Shishogi, and I went, you know, I knew he was saying something, but I sure didn't have a clue what. And it's been over the years that those verses have come to have meaning for me. So when this heart condition arose, I like everybody else, was trying to train with impermanence, but, you know, I thought, oh, well, maybe in my 80s I'll die, or that's when it'll happen. And then when this happened, I realized, oh, I could die quite suddenly. And let's just say that the leash got a lot tighter, which was very helpful. It was a gift to re-examine my life through an updated version of impermanence. We all know that as animal creatures, we share the wish, longing, and desire for pleasure and the aversion to pain, suffering, and death. So why has heart difficulties been a gift? Why is it a gift? And I hope by the end of the talk, that question will be clear. You'll have a clearer answer anyway. One of the most important lessons from my heart was to listen to it carefully, and when sensing to do or not do something, following it. Now that's standard, in one sense, what we do in meditation, is to be mindful and to listen and to be aware. And when we get those niggles in life, to pay attention to them and follow them. And in fact, when we don't, in hindsight, we all know, we look back and think, oh yeah, you tried to tell me, whoever that you is. it's certainly an aspect of our ongoing training. But when I mentioned the leash got tighter, that's part of how the leash got tighter was, oh, it's really important. Don't be so distracted. So very helpful. Now, as we all know, listening to 5 minutes even of the evening news, there's a lot of attention that's paid to things that are negative, wrong, or disasters. And we seem to have a perverse attraction to this negativity. I know I certainly do. And it's something that was true even at the time of the Buddha. With the internet now, there's so much information, this negative news can be rampant. And we are distressed and worried about all kinds of things that we wouldn't know about except for the internet. So that's the downside in one sense. Now, there is a good side to the internet. And as we talked about the late intro retreat, we talked about last night about how the internet connects us. We're aware of what's going on in the world, and in one sense, that's very important because we are all connected. And it does also serve to expose more readily people who are perpetrators of harm. So there's benefits to that. And still, we're filled with, I think, higher levels of anxiety and distress and a ain't it awful kind of attitude. So I'd like to read you a quote from Buddhist writings, which is part of the Buddha's last teaching. It's what he was giving a lecture, if you can imagine that, right before he died, literally, to his disciples. And what he says, he's talking about the practice of solitude, in admonishing his disciples to practice solitude. And he says, if you are one who enjoys the company of others, then you will take on the woes of their company, just as a flock of birds that gather in some huge tree, there is the lament of dead branches breaking off under their weight. That kind of reminds me of the evening news, quite frankly. Anyway, when the world binds itself around us, we drown in the suffering of such company, just as an old elephant, sunk down in the mire, is unable to drag himself out. So you can see that taking on the woes of the world is not a new problem. It's been going on for a long time. It's probably part of the human condition. And when the Buddha was talking about solitude, he was very aware that his monks lived often. Most of his monks lived in monasteries together. So what does he mean by solitude? And I think perhaps there's an aspect of solitude which involves refraining from getting caught up in things. And that can occur wherever we are, whatever we're doing. We can refrain from that hook, the things that hook us. And this is very hard to practice, and I myself was perhaps in need of paying attention to this very thing. My heart was prompting me to practice this relinquishment. I found that if I participated in negating views, that it caused a distress, and I actually felt it physically in my heart. Initially, I thought it was a lack of strength on my part, that my heart was just weak. But actually, I realized later that it was the prompting to practice solitude and to teach myself to look at what was going on. So one of the things is if we're talking to someone and they're starting to negate either other people or a situation, or it's, well, we can just politely excuse ourselves from the conversation and step away. We don't have to participate. I find that we can get our news from other sources where we can limit the impact of the charged situation, the events, the way it's said to us. We can take it in a better, kinder way. I used to love reading history, and even history became difficult to read sometimes. Now, I love history because it points to people who are altruistic or courageous in very difficult situations. And I find that inspiring. So that kind of became the filter from which I read history. If the story was about something like that, then I studied it. I think we can support ourselves by stepping back from too much negativity. And that's kind of the heart of what's being said here. Now, in my spiritual practice, true friends have mentioned to me that I have a dark and suspicious mind at times. And I recognize I'm prone to a negative take on situations. So this is for, you know, do we not all struggle with these things? So when I practiced this relinquishing of the negativity, I found that it actually softened that mind, which was very nice. And when we have compassion to ourselves and others, then we can seek a more generous view, a broader take on the situation, on life's events. You know, even things that seem terrible, there may be good going on within them. Who are we to judge? When someone is doing something, and we can recognize that it's not good to do, but we don't have to judge the person. We don't have to cut ourselves off from them. We can just recognize and be sympathetic. We can offer loving kindness to the situation or the person, or merit, or whatever. You know, it seems like you can either wallow in the negativity or be indifferent. Those are kind of the opposites. But in the middle, how do we respond to difficult things from the middle? And I think that we need to witness what is going on. I think it's very important to witness the suffering of this world, not to turn away from it and be overloaded or not to wallow in it, but to witness it with the eyes of compassion, to step into it by offering compassion to things. This is so important. And the compassion is really our refuge. It's for us, it's for others. Reciting mantras for the benefit of other beings in negative situations is another thing we can all do to help. or reading scriptures. This helps beings if we offer the merit to them. We don't know how things work. What do we know? We know so little. I certainly do. I think I know something, but I don't. But so these things help, and that actually gets things moving in a more positive direction for us. We can also look inward. What's our part in this situation? If we have someone who's really negative for us or difficult for us, what's our part in this situation? What is it that frightens us or disturbs us about the thing? I find that very helpful, because there's often, when I recognize what the perpetrator seems to be doing, I can relate. I share, like in September 11th, I couldn't understand why someone would do what they did. But then I saw that, they were frightened of us. And it's somehow, I'm frightened of them. Do you know what I'm pointing to? There's this ability to join together on things that seemingly pull us apart. And that's really important. But we have to look inward on it. We can look and see if the seeds of our own anger relates to the seeds of what we're seeing in someone else. And that's also very helpful. The Buddha taught the teaching of no separate self. Anatta is what he called. And this is a very profound and seemingly unique teaching of the Buddha, which I personally find very hard to understand. No separate self, because we all seem so solid, and we seem, of course there's a me. But the Buddha said, look at this differently. And after a while, of course, we do see the interconnectedness of each other. There are times when we all feel, love for each other and connected with other people. And yet not to take stuff personally is a real challenge. And I think to the extent that we don't take things personally, this is the extent that we are relinquishing some of our selfishness. So I find it a very good barometer to see how I'm doing. In challenging our negative reactions to various situations in news stories, instead of just accepting this negativity, but instead practice a more affirming view, this really serves to get the me and my out of the situation. We can open up to a more unbounded view of what is going on. It isn't really about us. It's about all of us connected. It's about karma and the law of cause and effect. And if we practice a more affirming view, it opens our hearts. And we see that we're connected with beings rather than cutting them off. When others do harm to themselves or others, we can be in sympathy with them. Don't we know what it's like to be crabby? Don't we know what it's like to be angry? It just changes. It's shifting how we look at it. So let's come back to the question of why do difficult situations become a gift at times? And this is actually one of the keys to what I'm trying to say here. Because seeing things as a gift is actually seeing a preciousness to life. By not viewing difficulties with our default reaction of negativity, it actually helps us begin to explore ourselves, what's going on inside us. And it opens us to a preciousness and a wonderful aspect. It's spacious. I think if we practice this turning inward, it opens us up to a preciousness of life that actually can be seen in the darkest of situations. And that people who do altruistic or courageous things in difficult situations are probably people who see a preciousness and are trying to help and respond and reach out to other beings. And this is what is inspiring. Reverend Master Jiyu, I hope I'm quoting this correctly. We have it inscribed on our great bell that we ring out. And if you hear it, the big bell gong in the morning meditation. This came out of a religious experience she was having, and she says, in quote, "From strange abysmal depths I have climbed and find the universe as fair and wondrous as the morning star." Please note, she says, from strange and abysmal depths. This is our world, strange and abysmal at times. But she found the universe as fair and wondrous as the morning star. That is the potential for all of us. Sometimes, even in the most difficult situations, people can transform from being victimized by their circumstances to becoming grateful for them, and grateful for the things they've learned. I love this. It inspires me. There is a movie called The Dharma Brothers, which was produced by Jenny Phillips, about a 10-day Vipassana retreat in a high-security prison in Alabama. And it's a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen it, I would encourage you to see it. Additionally, later she published a book in 2007, which is called Letters from the Dharma Brother, which she compiled and produced or printed. She's the editor of it. And it contains letters from the prisoners that they wrote to both her and other people who ran the retreat. And the letters are both ordinary, simple, and extraordinary, amazing to me. They are stories of transformations that can occur when one faces oneself. The book's so heartening and inspiring. You know, these guys are in a terrible condition. I mean, we have no idea how difficult it is. Or maybe we do, but it's a challenging situation. And yet, by being taught how to meditate and then opening themselves up, they could change and understand things about themselves. Now, I'd like to read a few of the letters. They're just simple sections I've taken. This is from a fellow, Leon, who, when he was coming out after the retreat, he said, "Even rougher than that was going back out into the general inmate population. All the noise, all the vibrations, everything was so loud. It was so loud. You know, the screaming, the normalcy of everyday prison life was. It took me a week to filtrate back into the swing of things." Then he replied in response to a question of what mistakes brought him here. "Bank robbery. If I had done Vipassana first, that wouldn't have been a reality, because I wouldn't have been deluded by my mind. I'd have seen things for what they really are. Had I learned how to love, even as a 10-year-old boy, things would have been different." This one is from a fellow named Charles. Jenny's talking about there's always an underlying sense of suffering and grief in prison life. And Charles says, "When you come to prison, you have let everybody down, even yourself. You lose friends, people you thought were your friends. You lose relationships, and everything just crumbles. It's as if you turn into nothing." I'm going to do two more actually. So bear with me, because I find these so helpful. This is from Larry, and he's talking about this is after practice. He's been practicing for a good while. And he's describing what happens. And he says, I've had people come up, be angry about something, and I can see that they're angry. So I automatically go into just thinking about, I wonder why he's mad, you know? Where before, he would come up and present an anger image to me, and I would automatically try to double that image back on him. But that's the way we deal with things here. Now it's just like one guy told me the other night. He said, man, you just sat there like I wasn't even talking to you. It just went right by you. And I said, yeah, right through me, more or less, you know. And then I said, I don't want you to get mad. Wow. Oh, can we remember that when someone gets angry at us? Boy, is that great teaching. The final thing I want to read is from Omar. He wrote this after many years of practice. And what he said, he's describing. Experiencing openness and learning to open myself more has allowed me to access more space in my existence. When an adverse occurrence arises around me, I'm less reactive because I have the space to see and act with skill. I'm less caught up in anger when it flares or any other negative feelings. I'm less hooked, if you will. I can let go. I have more space within me to be otherwise. I can let go and be kind or let go and be forgiving. I can let go because I have the power to do so. Thanks, Omar. That's a great teaching. May we all remember that. For all of us, with practice and precepts, we all have the opportunity to change and to become free. And this is what's precious about life. No matter what is going on, when we work on ourselves, even in the most difficult situations, we can become freer. We can open to the precious moment, which is this present moment. So much of the weight that I felt on my heart, I realized, I believe, comes from worry and not living in the present. Our worry doesn't help us, does it? I mean, we worry about all kinds of stuff, and it never goes the way we worry about, or even if it does, it's different. We have to deal with it. I remember they asked a woman who was 100 years old, what word of advice she had for people, and she said, oh, I worried about a lot of things and none of them happened. Do we want to be 100 and say that? We got to work on this. So being present in the moment actually opens us to the preciousness of life. And we don't have to worry. We can just be present to what's going on. If we're distracted or worried or whatever else, then we're not really seeing things as they really are. We're missing sometimes a little flash of light, a little flash of knowledge, a little flash. And I think that flash is the affirming spark of life. That flash is mentioned in our daily scriptures. For example, the most excellent mirror samadhi says in different places, this is far beyond all common consciousness, beyond all thinking. See, the wooden figure sings and the stone maiden dances. But to make two arrows meet head on goes far beyond the mind of ordinary man. This is what we can experience, we can live from, these incredible little moments which actually serve to encourage our faith and deepen our practice. to make the world different begins by changing our mind, learning not to act on negation, but instead choosing to affirm it. And I'd like to read a quote from The Mother of All Buddhas by Lex Hickson. This poem is from a 14th century Lama. And actually, it's one I read sometimes when I want to offer merit to the world. Now, I'm not going to read you the whole thing. It's great. But this is one stanza out of 27, and I find it helpful. So he says to us, all of us, transform the intense activity of daily life into the harmonious expression and teaching of truth by affectionately reminding and being reminded that the dark, bitter fruits of negating others are poisonous, to be carefully avoided, while the sweet, bright fruits of affirming others are life-giving, to be thoroughly enjoyed. Authentic delights exist only in serving others, and suffering springs only from harming others or insensitively ignoring the needs of living beings, all of whom are as intimately related to us as our own precious mother and father. So preciousness is within our moment-by-moment existence. And here is what we all share, because we all have to practice it. It doesn't come without practice. Or let's just say it may come on rare occasion, but that coming often brings us to practice. So my question to you all is, what are you going to do with the rest of your life from this moment on? Oh, what a good idea. And is there something inside yourself that you would like to shift, you'd like to change? And if so, how are you or we going to practice that? How are we going to do that? Dogen says, training is enlightenment. There is no separation between our practice and enlightenment. So we have to practice. And that's what's so precious about life. And that's why it's such a gift. Because whatever's going on, we get to practice. Practice with it and learn. And it's fun. I'll end from a quote of a Zen author, D.T. Suzuki, who said this to Reverend Master Jiyu, before she left England to go to Japan to become a monk. And she had been translating things with him. And she asked him, you know, if he had had any religious experiences. I mean, I don't know, something like that. I don't remember what she asked him. But what he said is, once or twice I have had the great experience, but 1,000 times the little moments that make one dance. So we're all invited to partake in those little moments. Thank you very much.